Today is Friday, May 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a U.S. scientist who spoke out against the Trump administration's COVID-19 response tells Congress without a fast and improved response, the country will be in for a deadlier and prolonged crisis.
There will be likely a resurgence of COVID-19 this fall. It'll be greatly compounded by the challenges of seasonal influenza. Without better planning, 2020 could be the darkest winter in modern history.
Worrisome reports for the U.S. and global economies.
This is frankly another sickening punch to the gut, and unfortunately, we need to be braced for more incoming body blows along these lines.
Also ahead, a long list of big-name musicians will be gathering for an all-day online fundraiser next week. It's all on today's International Edition. A government scientist who says he was ousted from a high-level post after warning the Trump administration to prepare for the pandemic says the nation needs to do much more to avoid what he says is, quote, the darkest winter in modern history. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Appearing before a House panel, Dr. Rick Bright says his early virus preparedness concerns were dismissed. Among other things, he's worried about efforts to develop a vaccine.
We need to have a strategy and plan in place now to make sure that we can not only fill that vaccine, make it, distribute it, but administer it in a fair and equitable plan.
The White House has set up Operation Warp Speed to do that. And President Trump is disputing Bright's belief that it'll take longer than a year and a half to develop a vaccine.
I think we're going to have a vaccine by the end of the year. And I think distribution will take place almost simultaneously.
He's calling Bright an angry and disgruntled employee. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The head of a Paris-based pharmaceutical company Thursday walked back his comments from a day earlier that some countries would get priority access to a coronavirus vaccine. Sanofi's chief executive Paul Hudson said he was sorry for remarks that any vaccine developed by Sanofi Pharmaceuticals in the United States would go to U.S. patients first. The remarks created a firestorm that led to admonishment by the French government and European Union leaders. De Kiers Mocker, health policy spokesman at the European Commission, in a virtual press conference from Brussels Thursday said any response to COVID-19 must be done with close coordination and solidarity.
The vaccine against COVID-19 should be a global public good, and its access needs to be equitable and universal.
Scientists are rushing to find treatments and vaccines for a disease that has now killed nearly 300,000 people worldwide, including more than 84,000 in the U.S. Joining us now for more on this firestorm is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, this really angered the French president in particular.
Indeed, because French President Emmanuel Macron has really made the fight against COVID-19 and the rush to get some sort of vaccine has been a global issue. It's never been an issue of the richest countries, the wealthiest countries. This has always been a global issue. And that was why France was at the forefront alongside other European nations earlier this month, when they got together and raised $8 billion to put towards global vaccination programs and for developed diagnostics. So when the British chief executive of Sanofi said just a few days ago that the American government had the right to the largest pre-order any possible vaccination because the Americans had invested in it, had taken the risk, it was just complete surprise, not just in France, also in Europe. Suddenly, a vaccination, such a vaccination, had become a commercial proposition. It had gone into the realms of the French really like the idea of a capitalist, a money-driven medical solution. And they really didn't like this. Within a few minutes of the chief executive saying this, the French health minister got on the phone to Sanofi and said, I hope I have misunderstood this. And of course, the head of Sanofi France did come back and say, well, the goal is to make the vaccine available to the US and to the Europeans at the same time. But by then, again, the damage had been done. The great fear that this vaccination would go to the richest, the biggest, bigger ever, that is already out there now. The fact that this was said, it needed to be verified, has shocked many people in Europe, because this is not the sort of thing that one is used to when you're in an environment where everyone has the same access to vaccination. It's left a very unpleasant taste in everyone's mouth.
I understand President Emmanuel Macron was so upset about it that he's called for the company to come to a meeting next week.
He has indeed. I mean, let's talk, one of the reasons that Sanofi said that this vaccination would go to the US first was because they said that the US government had invested in their company, had invested financially so much this year. But of course, Sanofi is a Paris-based company, has received tens of millions of euros from the French state in recent years in the form of research credits and tax credits. So you can work this both ways. But certainly the announcement from Emmanuel Macron's office that there are, and the quote from the office was that vaccination is a global public good. It is not submitted to market forces. That was the explanation they gave for Emmanuel Macron being so angry, and the explanation why the company and its executives have been called into the French presidential palace early next week.
And Catherine, along the same lines as your president, Emmanuel Macron, is saying a vaccine shouldn't depend on whether or not someone can afford it, that it should be available to all people equally. Apparently, other nations around the world are also speaking out about that very philosophy.
Indeed, some 140 world leaders and experts have signed an open letter saying that any vaccination should be a people's vaccination. It should be made swiftly and at no cost to all people.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. The U.S. didn't participate in a pledge last week by world leaders and organizations to spend $8 billion to manufacture and distribute a possible vaccine and treatments. More than 90 vaccines are currently being developed globally, with 8 in the clinical trial phase. Well, as the global race to find a vaccine against the coronavirus intensifies, medical researchers are looking for people to participate in clinical trials to test potential vaccines in humans. One such study is taking place at one of America's leading research institutions, Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Hayde Adams Fitzpatrick spoke to a man who signed up for Emory's clinical trial. Jack Crost is a senior digital writer at the Weather Company who explains what's involved with the trial, what the risks are, and why he's doing it.
I want to get this immunity, so it's possible I will benefit. I'm betting that the virus is worse than the vaccine. And from what I've heard, there haven't been any serious side effects in the initial small group of people that have been tested.
So, Jack, there are three phases to this trial, and you say you're waiting to hear if they're going to include you in the second phase, when they'll be testing whether or not the vaccine is effective. What are they telling you about the risks involved, and what exactly makes for a good candidate?
Yes, it definitely is a risk. They're very clear that they don't know what the risks are, and that's why they're doing these trials. Even after they determine, Emory University determines that there are no risks, it would have to go through FDA approval, and that would be even more rigorous. You know, initially you're screened to check on your medical condition. They take two sets of blood work, other tests that go over your medical history, and then if they determine that you're a good candidate, then they'll give you the vaccine. Then about a month later, they'll give you another shot of it, a booster shot. Then after that, you go back first in a week, then in a couple of weeks, then in a month, then in a couple of months, then in 6 months, and finally a year. First, they want to see how you're doing. And secondly, they want to see whether you're developing antibodies, whether you're developing immunity to the virus. So you aren't being exposed to the virus. They just want to see if your body is getting a reaction to the vaccine.
What are you learning about how a vaccine trial actually works?
Now, this is fairly new technology. They, and in a way, it's sort of artificial. They use a technique called RNA sequencing. Your body's cells respond by creating a viral protein that mimics the coronavirus. So your body thinks it has coronavirus and it's hoped you develop antibodies to it. So it's different from a flu shot in that you're not being injected actually with COVID-19. Now, I don't know whether that makes it safer. I'm hoping it does. But the unique thing about this vaccine is that it's faster to develop in only 42 days. But even though that was fast, it still takes a long time to go through these trials. They expect at least a year before they determine whether it works and whether it's safe. They started with one group in Seattle, and then they're doing more trials with another group in Atlanta. And then in addition to that, there's several different age groups. They started with 18 to 55-year-olds. They have better immune systems. And then they're moving on to 56 to 70-year-olds. I have to admit, I'm in that group. And then after that, they'll be moving on to 70-year-olds and older.
Jack, are there moments when you have second thoughts, when you wonder whether or not you're doing the right thing?
Yes, I do. I tried to weigh it, and it seemed to me like the advantages of doing this outweigh the disadvantages. I'm hoping they call me up, and I will be in touch with them to see my check on my status. And I think I'm going to do this.
That report brought to us by Haid Adams Fitzpatrick. Experts say the process of finding and distributing a vaccine, though, could take years and may not happen at all. There is still no vaccine for HIV, which emerged in the early 1980s. Meanwhile, the economic impacts of the pandemic cannot be understated, AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
Nearly 3 million laid-off workers applied for U.S. unemployment benefits last week as the viral outbreak led more companies to slash jobs, even though most states have begun to let some businesses reopen under certain restrictions. Another week and another grim unemployment report.
This is frankly another sickening punch to the gut. And unfortunately, we need to be braced for more incoming body blows along these lines.
Mark Hamrick, senior economic analyst with Bankrate.com.
We're well above 30 million total new claims for unemployment benefits. We know that the unemployment rate was elevated in the month of April, and there's no relief on that front either.
And the solution remains the same.
We need a vaccine. We need the vaccine deployed. We need to have effective treatment.
I'm Shelley Adler.
The ongoing wave of layoffs has heightened concerns that more government aid is needed to sustain the economy through this recession. Without another rescue package, many economists worry that thousands of small businesses will go bankrupt, leaving millions of unemployed with no business to return to. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said a $3 trillion bill proposed by the Democratic-led House of Representatives that provides aid to states and essential workers is totally unserious. And he didn't promise there would be another aid bill.
We're going to insist on doing narrowly targeted legislation, if and when we do legislate again, and we may well, that addresses the problems, the needs, and not the aspirations of the Democratic majority in the House.
But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a news conference Thursday said that by not taking the relief bill seriously, the Senate Majority Leader is showing a lot of tolerance for, quote, the pain of others.
He wants us to just pause. He wants us to just pause. But families know that hunger doesn't take a pause. Not having a job doesn't take a pause. Not being able to pay the rent doesn't take a pause.
U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell this week stressed his belief that Congress should consider providing additional rescue money to avoid prolonging an economic catastrophe. Well, the economic pain is not limited to the United States. Virtually every country in the world is suffering a severe economic downturn due to the coronavirus pandemic. But some nations have so far fared better than others in mitigating the impact on businesses and workers. VOA's Brian Padden reports that advanced countries that have moved aggressively to contain the outbreak are coping better economically, while developing nations lacking resources to protect the vulnerable are most at risk.
South Korea, Singapore, and Vietnam are examples of countries that acted early and effectively to contain the coronavirus outbreak by shuttering businesses, implementing widespread testing, and tracing people exposed to the virus. As a result, economists say, these nations are having the most success reopening their economies.
If that's in place, that as you reopen the economy, you actually can foster confidence, because among the unknowns here are the way that consumers are going to respond to a gradual reopening.
Advanced countries in Asia, Europe, and North America have engaged in massive relief efforts to compensate businesses and workers for the loss of income during economic shutdowns. Countries like Germany have kept unemployment relatively low by reimbursing companies to keep idle workers on the payroll. In the United States, which is experiencing massive job losses, worker benefits are channeled through unemployment programs. But gaps in these programs have left many Americans increasingly dependent on food assistance. Developing countries struggling with widespread poverty before the pandemic have been hit especially hard by the steep decline in global exports and world tourism. Warning of a hunger pandemic, the United Nations has appealed for nearly $7 billion in humanitarian aid to help those most at risk.
Humanitarian aid is not just a moral imperative. It is a practical necessity to combat the virus. If COVID-19 wreaks havoc in the poorest places, we are all at risk.
Despite a growing need for economic assistance, fiscal conservatives are increasingly resistant to boosting U.S. government debt that already has ballooned by the trillions of dollars since the pandemic began. They warn that runaway spending will necessitate tax increases and austerity measures that will slow economic growth for years to come. But until a coronavirus vaccine or reliable treatment is developed, economists say it remains difficult to forecast how long or how severe the economic downturn will be. And they warn reopening businesses too early could prolong the crisis. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations is calling for mental health care to be given to millions of people suffering psychological distress from fear, loneliness, economic upheaval, and any abuse triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic. A UN policy brief, COVID-19 and the Need for Action on Mental Health, issued by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, explores the issues brought on by the crisis and offers recommendations. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
National surveys carried out this year reveal widespread prevalence of distress in populations, with levels as high as 35% in China, 60% in Iran, and 45% in the United States. Similar studies among healthcare workers find anxiety levels have risen an average of 45% in countries such as Canada, China, and Pakistan. Devorah Kestel is director of the World Health Organization's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse. She says measures must be taken now to protect and promote care for such existing conditions.
This is something that needs to be done in the middle of the crisis, so that we can prevent things to become worse in the near future. We are all witnessing in every country of the world the risk of an economic turmoil that will affect people.
Kestel says mental health problems have surged during similar economic crises in the past, leading to high rates of suicide. One of the major recommendations in the UN Secretary General's policy brief is to ensure mental health and psychosocial support are widely available in any emergency. What may be feasible in rich countries may not be possible in the developing world. For example, WHO notes one in five people in South Sudan has a mental health condition, with only one professional available for every 4 million people. Kestel tells VOA that the WHO and other agencies have been working for years to strengthen the capacity of non-mental health professionals to provide care.
We are promoting the modalities where the community, some community leaders or sectors within the community, such as traditional healers in some context, could receive the basic knowledge and training that is needed in order to provide care to those in need.
The United Nations says psychological trauma will remain after COVID-19. The disease caused by the coronavirus is gone. It urges nations to reform, strengthen, and invest more money in their mental health care systems. It says these services will be needed to support societies as they recover from the terrible consequences of this life-changing event. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coping with the COVID-19 pandemic has been a personal trial for almost everyone in the world, but from a professional point of view, health and hospital workers are facing some of the most difficult challenges. The response against COVID has also meant heroic efforts by many workers behind the scenes as they procure equipment and supplies and organizing personnel. For the next part of our ongoing series of interviews with those on the front line, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with veteran nurse Christina Masvidal, now the Senior Director of Patient Safety and Risk Management for Jackson Health Systems in Miami, Florida.
So we are always quite busy, like you just said, but when COVID came into the picture, it was kind of like watching a hurricane that was out in the ocean and you were waiting for it to hit your city. And we were doing as much as we possibly could to prepare and anticipate based on what we heard internationally, which wasn't such great information, right? And you're trusting an outside source. We had to break down every process that we normally anticipate and are trained for, but step it up exponentially, understanding that this virus was very, very lethal.
What did that involve specifically?
So anything associated with corona, from preparing our staff, ensuring that they felt comfortable to take care of these patients, to gathering our protective eye and body gear, to making sure that we had enough rooms that could possibly anticipate the number of patients we would receive during this pandemic.
That meant a lot more equipment too.
Right. We had to make sure we had the ventilators. We had to make sure that we had enough staff trained on those ventilators, that we had enough ICU nurses, and that we could actually reorganize the other staff for elective surgeries and put them in other parts of the hospital to kind of decompress the stress on the staff. So you really felt like I'm just doing the best I possibly can for a storm that I really never was trained to deal with. We dealt with tuberculosis and other infections that come in internationally, but this was impacting different ages, different demographics, and it was having such an impact on the immune system that we did not know our normal practices would even work.
This wasn't just a clinical crisis. It was also a personal crisis for many of your colleagues.
Right. This one was more isolating. We really couldn't go back to our families. We needed to protect our families. And understanding that you are the front line, we are grateful to have our jobs. But again, I believe some staff would actually have hoped that they wouldn't be required to be that frontline healthcare provider.
So it's also your job to attend to the fear and the burnout among the staff.
Absolutely. That was something I also made sure we brought into play. And we created a on-call beeper that literally staff could page in real time to receive therapy if needed. And our teams have been using it as a nurse or any healthcare provider. You just feel this overwhelming grief that everyone's experiencing. All these people that have died, not even having family at their side, and the funerals that are not occurring. And any patient right now who's dying does not have a loved one at their side. So as a nurse, that's an additional stress.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Virtual reality tours have replaced flag-waving rallies as Palestinians facing coronavirus restrictions create digital spaces to lament the loss of their physical homeland in 1948. Cell phone apps and Zoom video chats are among the other online tools Palestinians are using to mark the Nakba, or catastrophe, when they and their descendants were forced from their villages or fled in the war that surrounded Israel's creation. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's top team of ministers agreed on Thursday that Britain will not give up its rights as an independent state by bending to the demands of the European Union in its talks on a future relationship. At a cabinet meeting, Johnson's team was updated on the talks by negotiator David Frost, who told them that Britain was not asking for anything special, bespoke, or unique in the talks, just a free trade agreement. And accused criminals across the U.S. have started using the threat of deadly COVID-19 infection as a weapon in attacks on police, retail clerks, and grocers trying to keep the nation fed during lockdown. Threats of spreading COVID-19 have occurred from coast to coast, raising questions about whether states will move to criminalize the weaponization of the novel coronavirus, the way more than half of U.S. states made undisclosed HIV exposure a crime when the AIDS crisis erupted in the 1980s. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. Yemen has closed airports, schools, and restricted some travel by land, but people are still on the streets, riding in crowded buses and gathering in mosques. As COVID-19 cases spiked to 70 on Thursday, more than twice the number 5 days before. The UN says a widespread outbreak in this war-torn country would be a disastrous blow to a people already in the throes of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from Istanbul with Naseh Shaker in Sana'a.
Outside the gates of the old city in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, crowds of people gather to buy clothes and food as they celebrate Ramadan, the Islamic holy month. It is also crowded inside the old city, where 23-year-old Muhammad Ali Al-Khawlani makes and sells clay pots for cooking traditional Yemeni food. He says he and his family are celebrating this year as they always do, in mosques, homes, and on the streets, with large groups of family and friends. Like many people in Sana'a, he is not concerned about the coronavirus. The Houthi government that runs Yemen's north says Sana'a has only had 2 cases, but the government that controls Yemen's south has called its regional capital, Aden, infested with the virus and accuses the Houthis of not reporting cases. World Health Organization officials say they assume that the disease is already circulating more widely in Sana'a, and if more preventative measures are not taken, the results could be catastrophic. This is WHO Yemen representative Altaf Moussani.
It was a matter of time whereby we would start to witness cases in Yemen. And I want to take a couple seconds to address this. This virus does not respect borders. This virus doesn't need a passport to enter any country.
Yemen's northern and southern governments have been at war since 2014, both backed by powerful international allies. The United Nations says roughly half the population of Yemen is at risk for starvation or diseases like cholera, and 80% of the people rely on humanitarian aid. Yemen was one of the last countries in the world to report its first case of COVID-19, and WHO officials in Yemen say, for them, the battle against this virus has only just begun. Heather Murdoch for VOA News in Istanbul, with Naseh Shaker reporting from Sana'a, Yemen.
Close to 40 artists will be participating in a day-long performance live streamed on social media platforms next Wednesday, with Kenny Chesney, Brad Paisley, Sheryl Crow, and Avril Lavigne among the dozens of talent set to join Feed the Frontline Live. Charity is providing free food to frontline workers and, in the process, helping support local restaurants. The streams will be hosted on CMT's Facebook and YouTube channels. In reflection of the beneficiary, the All-Star live stream will be broken up into 3 separate meal-themed components, one for breakfast, one for lunch, and one for dinner. Performances shot at home by the stars will be interspersed with stories of frontline workers and the local restaurants who've been enlisted to feed them. Yeah. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Take care, be well, and have a good weekend. But I'd much rather sleep.
somewhere with you, like we did on the beach last summer when the rain came down and we took cover down in your car out by the pier. Let me down, whispered in my ear, I hate my life, hold on to me. All if you ever decide to leave, then I'll go, I'll go, I'll go.